Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Leading Edge Love Radio. This is your host, Sumati Sparks, the Open Relationship Coach. Have you ever wondered how well-suited you are for ethical non-monogamy? Well, you can find out by taking my quiz. And you can find the quiz right on the homepage of my website, sumatisparks.com. That's S as in Sam, U, M as in Mary, A, T as in Tom, I, Sparks, as in sparks are flying, .com. And when you enter your email, you'll be added to my mailing list as well, and you'll be the first to learn about both my online events as well as my live events in the San Francisco Bay Area. So tonight, I'm really excited to have as my guest, Dr. I'm going to get the first name right, Zaleika Hepworth-Clark, is a sexuality educator, an African-centered social worker, cultural and clinical sexologist, a sexuality counselor, consultant, and autoethnographer. Dr. Clark, known as the Jamaican sexosopher, is the first Jamaican-American to receive 3 degrees in human sexuality from accredited universities in the United States. Dr. Clark co-founded a sexuality studies program at Goddard College in Vermont, where she helped co-create the Decolonial Sexual Attitude Restructuring Assessment, or DSAR. DSAR is a unique and innovative sexuality training program that helps participants understand the impact of settler colonialism, imperialism, white supremacy, capitalism, and cis-heteropatriarchy on their relationships to gender, sexuality, and relationships. Welcome to the show, Dr. Clark.
Thank you so much for having me. Peace and blessings. I'm so excited to be here.
So glad to have you. So that was a mouthful, but I really wanted everyone to hear like what your work is about. It's so needed, and I first want to thank you for taking on this behemoth of a job of, you know, changing our attitudes and decolonializing the way we think about sexuality and relationships. It's just such a huge pushing a boulder uphill. And I just want to thank you for taking that on and kind of go into a little bit about how you got into being a sexologist. It's not something that, you know, everybody gets into. And you have this background, your roots in Jamaica. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about how you got into this field.
Sure. Well, I love following my heart and passion, and I was blessed to have a family that supports me in kind of allowing me to have freedom to study whatever I wanted. And growing up between New York and Montego Bay, Jamaica, I noticed differences in cultures. And my mom's an identical twin sister, and so my aunt is a lesbian, and my mom is straight, and one's right-handed and one's left-handed, and like they're mirror twins. And so I noticed different different morals, different attitudes, different just different ways of being and expressing love in America versus in Jamaica. And each culture seemed really sure of itself, like this is the best way or something like that. But knowing, just being exposed to multiple ways of doing things and loving, I really started to get curious. Like in America, I was being perceived as black, but in Jamaica they would call me white. So even race was like, okay, this is interesting. Or from the music, the smells and the sounds, there's just different histories that inform. So I got to have the freedom to create myself and really think about what was important to me. And and I was supported and so like when I was, my mom would take me to Barnes and Noble and say, get whatever book you want. I'm like, really? Any book? And so I found my way into like the self-help section and would get like, I don't know, Our Bodies, our Choice, like just different like sexuality books were really the ones that were fascinating to me. And so, I was just able to kind of study that and know that I was interested in taboo topics. I was just interested in, like, how did we get here? Oh, people had sex. And so it was just kind of like also just thinking about life-giving forces and my reason for being here and really being able to study that. And so I took it very seriously. I went to NYU and studied sexuality, culture, and oppression at the Individualized School of Gallatin. And then I wanted to continue studying sexuality. And so I just continued, got my master's in education of human sexuality and my doctorate in philosophy and human sexuality from Weiser University outside Philadelphia.
Beautiful. So you have a doctorate in philosophy, so that's why you call yourself a sexosopher.
Right. Yes. I also love the philosophy of sexuality, and in particular, sexual epistemology, which is a form of psychology that studies basically the knowledge of knowledge, how we know what we know, how knowledge is transmitted, interpreted. And I really got interested in sexual knowledges across different cultures as well. So the sexosophy is, I love the philosophy of sexuality and talking about it and brainstorming and talking to different perspectives and sharing different insights from different ways of knowing and thinking and experiencing love, desire, pleasure, passion, relationships, and things like that.
Well, I want to dig a little deeper into all of that, especially about the different cultures with your mother and your aunt. But before I do, I just want to say that I love how you play with language, but it's really more like you explode language, you drop a bomb into language. And I saw that you talk about being a decolonial eroticologist. So, just in general, can you talk about how you relate to that exploration with language, and then maybe define some of those terms for us that you use?
Sure. Culture moves faster than language, and you see with the newer generations and just emerging cultures that language is trying to catch up to phenomenon or experiences. I find it challenging to put a lot of our experiences into words. And so within the field of sexuality, I've found some jargon that is more helpful in articulating what I mean. And so, but just to, you know, English is a sexist language. It has binaries and hierarchies ingrained into the words and the syntax structures of the sentences. So it informs the way we think and the way we experience our lives. And you can see with people who speak different languages, they're able to know things in different ways according to the language. And so I just acknowledge the limitations that language has, especially around talking about certain experiences that there may not be the words for. And so in terms of, you know, being a sexologist, there's many different kinds of sexologists, and we all have different specialties and areas of expertise. And I've been trained as a clinical sexologist, so, you know, I can work with on issues related to sexual.
I'm sorry, you cut out for a second. Issues related to?
Okay. Are you hearing me now?
Yes, okay. I am. You said
sexual,
issues related to?
Yes. Sexual challenges, or just doing, like, work around sex therapy and relationships. And my culture, I love the cultural construction of sexuality and have participated in anthropological research around sexualities and relationships. And And so the eroticology and the erotic, being an eroticologist is kind of my specialty in that I take serious the study of eroticism or the erotic. And in particular, I became in love with Audre Lorde's work around erotic as a source of power and information, a creative energy and life force. It understands our capacity for joy and satisfying, fulfilling experiences. And oppression distorts this power. And so the work that I do is to undo this damage and revive the replenishing, provocative life force and like inspire and remind people of their erotic intelligence, which can function to, which can encourage excellence and give us strength to pursue excellence and pleasurable experiences without shame. And so I really, that's kind of my area of specialty, and in particular African eroticism, which doesn't rely on Western sexual ontology or Western ways of being sexual. So that's just and then also the decolonizing part is just recognizing that I am acknowledging sexist, homophobic conditioning and kind of being I'm taking a stand in that I'm committed to unlearning negative effects of colonialism and exploring sexuality outside of patriarchy and really problematizing the histories of hegemonic structures or power that oppresses people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I combine
the more I get it, and I really appreciate that. There's just so much shame and secrecy around our eroticism. I have so many things I want to ask you about. I'm just going to pick one. Okay, so the more I geek out on polyamory and really expand my own awareness of our programming, the fewer people I feel like I can date, because I see how most people, and I'm almost 60 years old, so when I date people in my age group, there's like such programming, I can just see it, you know. So how do people unlearn, like what are some of the negative effects of colonialism? And it's a big question, but like maybe just give us a taste of that, and how do we begin to even unravel that?
Yeah, so a few things. I mean, once your mind is expanded, it's hard to go back to old dimensions. And so just operating on different frequencies, you'll just start getting more clear around the joys that you want or what you want in your life and what to be a part of. And so negative effects of colonialism. Well, the first one I have to mention is the atrocities done to indigenous people and the kind of stolen land. And so it is a issue, decolonization is an issue of land and getting the sovereignty back. And it shows up in so many different ways, like even state-sanctioned encouragement of what a nuclear family should be. So even having privileging the gender binary and the couple-centric forms of relationships and nuclear family that was co-constructed with settler colonial domination of land and resources. Even kind of how we are thinking, our morals, our worldviews, the capitalism, the heteropatriarchy, the kind of, the idea of possessiveness of partnerships, the privileging of romantic and sexual partnerships over all others, like platonic relationships or, you know, other things. So it's this kind of systematic infrastructure with that hat that sustains dominant heteronormative assumptions and uplifts patriarchal mentalities and white supremacy. And so that shows up in for different people in different ways, whether that's internalized hatred or not being aware of the power that we have, and or being in tune with the joys and pleasures that our body can provide for us, in the way that we relate, in the way that we love, and how we what we're allowed to love, or how we're going to be rebelling against that. So I think it can show up in terms of shame. I think, you know, a lot of times I may have a pleasurable experience, and it's the kind of colonial mentalities that prevent me from experiencing the full joy that my body has the potential for, because it's all the messages, even expressing emotion or crying or how I'm supposed to react in a certain way. It's all kind of scripted, this the relationship escalator, all that pressure to live my life and get married and have kids and do, you know, participate as the society kind of pulls that from you, or there's like a pressure, a type of pressure.
And so
when you don't fit in. Yeah, just like a, it's just there, kind of, and so there's so much to unlearn, there's so much to heal from, even just the way we relate to nature, and the way we relate to each other, and just what's even allowed legally. I think about all of, you know, how people who practice non-monogamy, we don't have rights. We're not protected under the law for employment discrimination or housing discrimination, or being able to marry our other partners. Mm-hmm. And so there's just a lot of work to be done, and it's sanctioned within society's laws and the power structures.
Right, and the cultural mores and the really ostracizing that you get if you don't participate. Like, if you don't, I get the question, why aren't you married? Like, I have a disease of some sort.
Right.
So yeah, there's just such, the expectation is so powerful. So wow, that was just so much. Thank you so much for that. And I wish we had, you know, 6 hours to get into all this. And I want to direct people to your teachings at the end of our interview here. But to take it back to non-monogamy, tell us how you support your polyamorous students and clients with all of this information and knowledge.
Yeah. Well, each person is very different. So I love self-determined learning and really tuning into each person in terms of their needs, and really being a part of their journey and discovering parts of themselves that is passionate and interested or curious about certain things. So, you know, for my students, I really like to create a space that is that encourages brave conversations and authentic expression with my welcoming. And so, really, and even in the language that I use, I really don't make assumptions about their love life or how many partners they are, their romantic interests, and kind of always leave it open. Any time that there is a learning opportunity, because I talk about sexuality and love, I'm able to sometimes include it into the curriculum. So just always exposing my students to polyamory, whether it's something required for me, it's usually not required for me to teach about ethical non-monogamy, but I always can end up finding ways, because whether that's when I teach my students who are social workers or clinicians or my sexuality students, it's I like to include relationship education into the sexuality curriculum and include poly vocabulary words. I mean, there's really fun, awesome words that comes from the polyamory community, and just increasing critical thinking around relationship hierarchies, and little things like, instead of saying classroom rules, I'll say guidelines or agreements that is co-created with the class, as opposed to me, you know, telling the classroom what the rules are going to be. I think that's more sensitive to some poly folks who are not really into the rules, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or if that's choosing a guest lecturer who are polyamorous, or just providing resources for further exploration. And,
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So you talked about going back and forth between New York and Jamaica and your aunt and your mother. And you mentioned that you're considered Black in New York and white in Jamaica. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, why was that the case?
Well, race is a construct, and America has really deep historical ties to the way they've constructed race. They have the one drop Black, you're Black kind of rule, and the passing histories, and a lot of colorism and texturism in terms of even the tightness of my curl, the politics of hair, and how that affects how people read me. You have this, the historical trauma in terms of slavery and how race was used in America is very different than how it was used in Jamaica. And so traveling in different parts of the world, perceived in different ways, they'll focus on different, they will project different assumptions onto my body. And so while in the United States there's only very limited racial constructions that really don't, that are problematic, because I'm mixed, you know, I'm both. So when I'm thinking, you know, if my mom's white and my dad's Black, why aren't I gray? Like, that was just my, you know, feeling. I'm just, you know, it took me a while to understand what America's obsession with the Black versus white thing. And so Jamaica just has a different conceptualization of skin tones, and so I'm read as, it's interesting because when my mom's with me in Jamaica, I'm not called whitey, I'm called brown, and like, so it is kind of relative. But if I'm the lightest person in the room, they will call me out on my light skin privilege, and as opposed to different constructions. And traveling to Brazil, it's completely different. I believe they have over 30 official races within their national consensus, and they construct race almost opposite of how American constructs it. So in Brazil, they called me Morena Clara, which is like a light brown person. And we don't even have, that's not even trans, their race that I was in Brazil isn't even translatable to America.
Wow.
So then be traveling in, whether that's Indonesia or different parts of Europe, there's also different ways that my race is read, and the meanings that has. It also comes with me speaking English, that comes with a certain privilege traveling. Knowing that, you know, being able to go into different worlds with different ways of understanding what a human is, what the connotations that people place on you, is definitely just something that I notice a difference, as opposed to only staying in one place it would be easier to internalize the messages that were projected onto my body. Like me being in this kind of body, I'm subject to being hypersexualized in the United States because of the histories of mulattoes I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to be exposed to multiple viewpoints, and so I kind of knew that I just began to see that it was more subjective than it was, because there was just different ways that I could be perceived, and so I just had to find my own truth within that.
Mm-hmm. That's super interesting. Thank you for sharing that with us. And you talked about being an eroticologist, and I think of erotic with like anthropologist, or I'm not exactly sure of the etymology of ologist, but is it appropriate to ask the question, what are some of the different forms of erotic expression that you discovered in all your travels?
I think love is articulated in different ways. I think there's many different forms of love. I think eroticology comes from Greek eros, which is a love, I think it's a sexual love, an erotic kind of love. And of course, they have different types of love. So many different types. So that is the kind of root of the eros. And in terms of different cultures, I think just even what's acceptable in terms of public display of affection, or what is compulsive to, like in Jamaica, it's almost like compulsive heterosexuality. And I feel like in America, it's compulsive monogamy. That's kind of like enforced and so how we're able to express ourselves freely in different hostile environments shows up differently. There's being a difference between what happens in the bedroom and in the home, and then what happens in public, and just the different things that are encouraged, whether that's through the music or the way we talk about love, how we express our love. And then that shows up in terms of like what we're expected, who we're expected to love, the type of lovemaking that gets, that is kind of informed by culture. So that's, whether it's where a penis is supposed to go, where it's not supposed to go, the wetness, or, what it's supposed to sound like, or, all these kind of restrictions. Jamaica has has the laws, colonial laws, of sodomy and debunkery laws that say anal, oral, and bestiality are punishable with prison for 14 years. So they still have these really old laws. So actually oral sex in Jamaica has been historically very, what do I call, maybe taboo or forbidden. And so there's a lot of unlearning, or even around menstruation, they're being, not supposed to engage in sexual activities during when a woman is menstruating. So just having the different restrictions will inform how you're able to express love, and so I just was able to witness that, oh wow, there's very strict, that in Jamaica you're not supposed to do that. In America they don't seem to care at all about oral sex. So just that was also very curious for me, just because I saw the differences, and so it kind of sparked my interest in further studying, like, why is it that way? And I think that trauma and history really do play a part in how in our morals and in our survival techniques for what is acceptable, and just being a good community member, and that means different things for different people, and different dressing, different form, what is considered sexiness. I mean, a big thing is like body types. I know in Jamaica, being they call fluffy is an endearment term for being thicker, and whereas in America, there's a lot of pathology around thicker people who they'll associate it with health, and whereas in Jamaica, if you're, they say maga is a word to, it's a word that means skinny, but it also connotates being unhealthy. So even what is considered beautiful, you know, they would, like an ideal body shape, they would say there's like a fat pum pum, for example. So they like a, you know, it's a certain aesthetic. And so there's even what we consider sexy or ideal or beautiful is also informed by culture, in my opinion. And so that's even goes into our genital self-esteem. If you're fitting in to what you think is normal, which is also informed by our culture, and there comes to be many consequences of that. Whether that's there's surgery options in the United States to get your genitals to be more what you think is beautiful, or even how are you supposed to put your pubes hair design or take it off, or there's so many politics involved in that, but it's also informed by generational preferences, what's going on in erotica. I think pornography has an influence in sometimes when people are consumers of pornography, they can that's a lot of where people get sex education from, and so they will inform what they think is kind of normal sexual practices and behaviors when that's something completely different.
Right. Yeah, and I was also thinking about when you were talking, well, before I continue, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Leading Edge Love Radio, and this is your host, Sumati Sparks, the Open Relationship Coach at sumatisparks.com. We're speaking with Dr. Zuleika Hepworth-Clark, who is a sexuality educator and African-centered clinical sexologist. And we're talking about all things colonialism, imperialism, white supremacy, and how capitalism and cis-heteropatriarchy affect our relationships with gender, sexuality, and relationships. And when you were if you'd like to ask Dr. Zell any questions, please feel free to call in. The guest number is 657-383-1132, 657-383-1132. You'll be put on hold, and we'll get to you when we have a break in our conversation. So feel free to call in. And we were talking about the various erotic forms of expression in different cultures as Dr. Zell has traveled to different cultures. And when you were talking about that, I was thinking about that kink kind of comes out of what's not allowed. So when you were saying that, you know, like, for example, oral sex is not really as kind of more frowned upon in Jamaica, more so than America, more so than the United States. The Oakland Symphony is playing in the background.
Yeah.
I call it the Oakland Symphony. that, boy, they must have some great kink play around oral sex there because it's not allowed, you know. Like, kink often comes out of the repression of certain behaviors. And oftentimes I've had my own fun with kink and have been grateful for the restrictions, because if everything is allowed and nothing is shamed, then there's kind of like no kink. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean,
so like we can like own it and kind of play with it and make it fun, as long as we're aware that you know, we're not acting out of some kind of woundedness. We're claiming it for our own eroticism.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. In Jamaica dancehall culture, where there's really intense dancing. And so when outsiders are, like, observing it, it could really seem like it's problematic to use Western lens to kind of approach this kind of scene. And, you know, it could look, it can look violent in the way that they're dancing. You know, a lot of people say, oh, that's so misogynistic. But when you start to tune into what's really going on and the power of the punani or the women dancing in these rhythms that, that is very aggressive or seen as aggressive versus seen as passionate, it's just interesting. It was helpful for me to view this in a, like a kinky lens because it can look like it hurts. I mean, some of the moves, they'll jump from high places and jump onto the partner or, you know, very elaborate dance moves that look that are not vanilla at all. I would say that. And so, just, you know, how they're negotiating and where the power, it's not necessarily, you know, we know that you can top from the bottom or there's a lot of power in subbing, for example. It's not just like this one-way thing. It's a very powerful exchange of different energies. And so, yeah, I think when you're restricted in more terms, like, you know, if you're not allowed to have oral sex and or anal sex or you can't have sex on your period, then the heterosex becomes more something, whether that's more positions that are more commonly used or there's just more to explore within the limited range of acceptable sexual behaviors. But yeah, I think kink is just a whole thing, and we even in the United States, there's just a lot of work to be done, especially around education. So just kind of preparing my students to be kink friendly practitioners and expose my students to different types of kink and how it can be used as a healing modality or therapeutic and when it's used in certain ways. And of course I love just promoting the aftercare and safety plans and knowing your limits. And so they actually each community has a lot to teach me. Each, you know, I've learned so much from the poly community. I learned so much from the asexual community. I learned a lot from the kink community. And I think to have, you know, learn from each other and kind of have dialogues around our cultural norms is important to progress the field.
Yeah, and the kink community especially, I think, has so much to teach the other communities about conversation and communication and negotiation.
Yes.
What's an ordinary conversation before a kink scene is very advanced for vanilla sexual partners.
Right.
Yeah.
But they're important to have, absolutely. And I love just the, you know, knowing your limits, your safe words, doing a thorough
and
sexual history.
Knowing what you even want. I mean, it's taken me my lifetime to get, I feel like I'm finally getting really, really good at knowing what I want and being able to ask for it. And that can especially take female identified people a long time to even know what we want and then to feel like we can ask for it without being labeled as a slut or a whore. So when I do ask for what I want very specifically, then I oftentimes get it. It's like, wow, this whole world is opening up to me about actually getting what I want for a change because I'm asking for it so clearly. And I'm going through like this revolution around it. It's literally taken me you know, 50 years to get there. It's not, it's really like busting out of that culture of like speaking out about owning your sexuality and what you want and believing that you deserve to have pleasure.
Absolutely. And like, you know, just being socialized to be a woman comes with all of this kind of baggage that we have to unlearn to even tune into our own erotic power and our desires to be able to self-advocate. I love this Alice Walker interview where she said sexuality is one of the ways we become enlightened, actually, because it leads us to self-knowledge. And just, I just love just, you know, some, we're conditioned not to know our power and our and to feel shame around our desires when that then you find spaces that it's not the case, and we have to learn to communicate and ask for what we need. We have to figure out even what feels good on our bodies and also mm-hmm. be aware of the changes that can occur because we transform. We may like different flavors, we may like, and also the context may change. So like if you're in another place or you're with another partner, you may be open to things that you may not have been open to in other ways. Different people may bring different aspects of yourself out.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's definitely a process. It's a process.
and very dynamic, and it's a dance that we do, and it's unique with each person we play with.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to move on to a different topic. I want to apologize. I intentionally changed the pronoun in your bio from they to she, because so many of my audience are mature people, and I also want to be able to reach out to people who aren't part of the, you know, sex educator community or the, you know, more Bay Area kind of liberal people. I want to be able to bring people in that are new to this way of thinking. And so I want to apologize for changing your pronoun. And I want to talk for a few minutes about pronouns and to help people who aren't familiar with this, because in the mainstream world, even polyamorous people often feel, and I'm mostly speaking, I don't know if it's really race related, but just more people that aren't exposed to other people that use different pronouns, mm-hmm. to help them understand, like, I want to hear your perspective as an educator on why should we have that sensitivity, and why do people use different pronouns, and why is that a thing now? Because I'm 59, so, you know, people of my generation are like often rolling their eyes about it. They don't understand
Absolutely.
It. So if you could speak to like the mature people, my mature audience, about why.
Okay. Well, first, I think it's challenging because we're limited by English. And again, English is a language that requires pronouns, where actually many indigenous languages don't require pronouns usage at all. They're genderless languages. So we're already set up for problematic speech when our language demands pronouns. Now, biologically speaking, there are more than five sexes. You know, people think that even chromosomally there's only two, male and mm-hmm. female, but actually there's intersex mm-hmm. and many variations and combinations. Biologically found in nature. Now, that's actually a hard thing for people to say. I'm either, you know, I can say I'm credentialed here. You got to believe me, there are more than two sexes. Now, gender, there are even more genders than sexes. That there are, that's not necessarily correlated. And your genitals do not dictate your gender. So that's also a very hard thing to unlearn. The children these days they understand that quick. There's not all the baggage to unlearn that older generations are. We have to unlearn all what we know for our entire life. We have to unlearn it and also make room for the facts that are coming out of science and these cultures that
yes, that's true.
That weren't here.
When, and my millennial friends, they have no problem with the different pronouns. and they really get it. And the more mature people, just it's so hard to remember. But I just want to repeat what you said. Your genitals do not dictate your gender.
That is correct.
Okay.
That's the first kind of lesson I have to teach with whether that's my older students or people that have been indoctrinated into certain binary hierarchical systems that don't allow for gender fluidity, because we have this kind of biological determinism that has been ingrained in us that has a lot of assumptions, and we have to unlearn cis sexism. So the issue is we assume that if a baby is born with a particular set of genitals, that they get assigned the sex at birth, and that they will identify and match the same gender that they were assigned at birth by the doctor. That just said, oh, it's a boy, it's a girl. Or then, you know, they have issues if it's a intersex, and, you know, a lot of historically they had to put them in surgery because they were so concerned that they didn't fit into the binary. We have made possibly 1% of the population that has ambiguous genitalia or would be intersex. So the pronouns thing, because our language requires it, we know that there's more than what we perceive, and we can't make an assumption based off of how we look about what the gender of that person is, because we don't know their story, we don't know their history, their trauma, we don't know. And so some people may be presenting in a certain way for safety. Some people may just be in a transitioning. There's so many different ways of being and so many different ways of expressing. Even thinking that we kind of know, or there's many cultures that believe that a human has both masculine and feminine qualities within an individual. And so some people feel more strongly expressing femininity or masculinity, and they may be in a body that society has deemed they should be expressing themselves in a certain way. So there's more, the younger generation is aware, there's language now that describes the disconnect between there's more choices, and there's more of a culture around that will support people living their truth and authentic way of being, which may not be what we've been conditioned to believe them to be. So we are not, other people are not experts of other people's bodies or identities. Each individual, you have the self-determination to know what your truth is and how you want to express yourself. And that may be no gender, agenders, that may be multiple genders, feeling masculine on certain times and feminine other times, and wanting the freedom to be able to express in certain ways. So naming someone, giving someone a name or a pronoun, it can be very violent when someone has worked their entire life to stand in their truth and to confess to you an essence of who they are in a really reductive way of putting a gendered pronoun onto that. It's culturally, it's a matter of cultural competence. So trans folks, non-binary folks, gender fluid people may not have pronouns that you would assume them to have. And it kind of, when you mispronounce someone, it can be experienced as an act of violence, that you do not, it's disrespectful. You don't respect who I am. You don't respect the essence of my being. And it's already situated in many oppressive context. So when we go to the doctor and fill out forms, or we have to put this or that on our passports and documentation, it's already a very hostile environment that forces colonial understandings of gender that limits you in terms of how you can be a human, when we know that there's more expansive ways of being able to express and articulate. So right now, what you have is people that want to be inclusive or more sensitive or respectful to different cultures, including people who are in tune with the gender expansive paradigm, that it can be very challenging. And so that pronouns is a very simple fix, but it's hard because it's almost like we have to unlearn, we have to untrain. It's almost like we have to learn how to speak a new language to accommodate mm-hmm. the shift in culture, which mm-hmm. is harder when we're older to really mm-hmm. unlearn that. So,
mm-hmm.
It's just important to, I always ask, you know, what are your pronouns? And I also make it optional because some people may be outed with their pronouns. You know, there's mm-hmm. not, they, them is the easiest pronoun. I actually prefer thee, zer as my pronouns. Mm-hmm. Now, most people have mm-hmm. not heard of that. And so then I have to go into a historical lessons on English and help you, just for people to be able to respect a name or a mm-hmm. way of calling someone. It's political, it's personal, and mm-hmm. it's important. It's hard to describe, mm-hmm. but I know that it's a part of unlearning cissexism. And if we can try our best to just either not use pronouns or just call them by their name, try not to make assumptions. Those are going to be uh-huh. really key in terms of being able to relate to people, to be able to mm-hmm. respect people, and to mm-hmm. and to stay up to date with our language.
Right. And it is hard when you're older. I mean, I sincerely want to honor people's pronouns really hard, and I still slip up, and I try, and I get it right. The more I practice, the better I do. But it is very, very
yeah.
hard when you're older.
And I think...
But I just want to say, when I was in my 20s, I read a book called Woman on the Edge of Time, or maybe I was in my 30s, Woman on the Edge of Time by Marge Piercy, and it was a feminist utopian novel, and they used the pronoun per, short for person, and I always thought that was so perfect, and it never really caught on. I just think that works so well. That
well, that is
just
actually
a person.
A pronoun. It's still, it's actually a pretty popular gender-neutral pronoun, too. So, yeah, that's another example of and it's just, I think you got it. You know, we need to practice. We need to be humble. We need to, you know, apologize when we catch ourselves, and just mm-hmm. be patient and just kind of keep trying.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. All right, so we have a little bit more time, maybe 5 more minutes, and I'm really curious about you use the term oceanality. How does oceanality intersect with open relating? So can you give us the Cliff Notes version of that?
So oceanality is African eroticism that firms the normality as pleasure. It's a dynamic, creative energy connector between intervening phases of sexuality and fertility paradigm. It outlines a sequential energy flow from desire, arousal, copulation, pleasure, fulfillment, conception, birth, and growth. But that flow doesn't need to result in sex and birth, but it does require the pleasure principle, which is a creative energy associated with Oshun's honey. So this is a term, oceanality, that was created by Nzegwu, a Nigerian philosopher and feminist and artist, and it talks about a concealed power that revitalizes and renews life. It's even the sexual activities are interpreted as spiritually and psychologically activating this force of change, transformation, and growth. And the feelings of sexual fulfillment that it produces can ensure social harmony and stability. So, you know, oceanality is a dynamic force. It's rich and complex, and its dualities can be found in women's sexual identities and can be offered to their partners with the birth of children in order to build communities and harmony through intimacy mm-hmm. and bonding. It's based off of Oshun, which is a Orisha. Orishas are basically personality archetypes or a divinity or a force of nature, or an aspect of God, or an energy matrix, to summarize quickly into English. But Yeah, and it's there's many different orishas, and this is found in different Afro-spiritual traditions. And so it's interesting because Oshun is associated with fresh water, with beauty and sensuality, and so much I can't even give justice to in a mm-hmm. moment. But the stories, Oshun had many lovers, many different husbands, mm-hmm. and she also mm-hmm. was married, for example, to Shango, who had multiple wives before they even became lovers. And so there's it's in a paradigm where it's kind of like a love that is in abundance, and it's non-monogamy is definitely the main relationship kind of flow in that, in the stories. Mm. And so it's just there's stories between metamors and stories between, you know, there's just lots of different love stories, and it's usually in the context of multiple. One
Beautiful.
Of my favorite concept within Oceanality is the devouring vagina, and it just kind of assigns agency to the vagina, and it engulfs the penis, it surrounds, it envelopes, it swallows, it makes the penis disappear, and pulling out is seen as an act of resistance. And it kind of alludes to just the re-swallowing and withdrawing maybe appeared resistance, but its seed is still pulled by the demanding vagina. And so I just I love the non it's a different way of understanding sex, and has
yes.
a different narrative that that assigns agency to the person who possesses the vagina.
I want to interrupt you because I want to give you time to tell people how they can reach you. We just have a couple of minutes left. But when you're talking about that, I wish I had more time to talk about the experience that I had last summer, that when you were describing it, it was exactly the experience I had. I was in community. It was a sex positive, mostly polyamorous community. And I had that experience of kind of like energetically being receiving, like being impregnated by this giant phallus of the community, and that everybody in the community were the co-fathers. So we'll talk about that another time, but I'm going to do some Google research on Oceanality. But I want to give you the last couple of minutes here to tell people how they can reach you, and anything else that you want to offer to our listeners.
Sure. I can be found, more information about me and my work can be found at zoleika.com. That's Z as in zoosexual, E as in ecosexual, L as in lactation, A as in aftercare, I as in intersex, K as in karma sutra, A as in asexual. And there you'll find a link to my webinar on Oceanality and non-phallocentric sex, which is through the Institute of Sexuality and Enlightenment. And I am going to be organizing a Decolonial Sextopia Unconference, where we'll have opportunity to imagine what sexual liberation can look like and get clarity around what needs to be unlearned or transformed or healed for a better future, and just thinking strategically about ways to decrease the distance towards liberation. I'm still accepting clients at my business called The Pluriversity, and whether that's therapeutic or educational needs, I'm open and available. And I guess the last thing I'd like to say is a message from Dr. Kim Tallbear from the Critical Polyamorist, who says, "May your networks of love and relationships be many and not caged with settler colonial norms of individualism and hierarchies of life, ownership of land, water, bodies, and desires." So with that, I just like to conclude, may we love in the abundant paradigm and in ways that liberate us. So thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. This was a brilliant conversation. I wish you all the best. in your career and your teachings. So thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, good night.